Revelstoke, Enderby, Sycamose, Kimberly, Castle Carcarn, Brooklyn Trail, New Denver, and Windermere, Sparwood, and Invermere, Silverton, Fruinfruit, Bale, Care, Amios, Penticton, Osoyoos, and Princeton, Summerland, Vernon, and Salmo, the Colonus Lake Country, Oyamath, and Colstrim, Salmon Arm, Lumpy, and Caslow, there's Grand Forks and Greenwood, the Radiant, Hot Springs, Elkford, and Armstrong, and Peachland, Oliver, Nesca, Midway, Crest, and Golden, and Montrose, and Rosslyn, and Slocan.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is May 3rd, 2018, and this is episode 84. Politicos is a podcast that talks about West Coast politics. If you haven't already, subscribe to us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicos Pod, and support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/politicos.
I'm Scott Blainboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. You're hearing the soothing vocals of Justin McElroy singing the name of every town in British Columbia. Let's take a listen.
Vancouver, Surrey, Abbotsford, Burnaby, Belcher, and Coquitlam, West and North Vancouver, Pemberton, then Whistler, both with Langley's and Mission, Delta, which has both Tawasin and Lenore, then White Rock, Pocoran, Port Moody, Lion Space, Squamish, New Westminster, Richmond, and who can forget UP City, Bowen, Island, and Gibson, Sea Trail, Powell River, head up to Prince George and Prince Rupert, Pitt Meadows, and Maple Ridge, Agassiz, Chilliwack, and Taos, Tarqua, and Stewart.
On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the tax revolt. And then not a lot really happened in BC politics this week. The legislature's off. So we have a roundup of quick takes to get into. First, though, as always, we have to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Teds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. I also want to direct you to our Patreon, where we've adjusted the Patreon goals a bit. It turns out producing more than one podcast a week, and in my case, sometimes two, takes a lot of work. So we're trying to figure out what is more reasonable and what's more feasible. I mean, we'll still commit that if we make something like $100,000 a month, we'll start our own political party and let you give us ideas for it. We're 100% down for that. So help us get there. In the more feasible term, help us get a bit more so that we have more people in our Patreon circle. And then we're going to start monthly pub nights. And hopefully that can feed into live shows. And we'll save up some money and do live shows here in Vancouver and hopefully in Victoria very soon. Soon meaning probably the summer, but stay tuned for that. Also, Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, the brand new daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. And we wouldn't have even half as much content as we have for this show in particular if it wasn't for this newsletter. So do sign up for your free trial to get that unique coverage delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners receive 25% off subscriptions when you enter the offer code Politicos. And because they learned recently publications in BC aren't subject to the PST, it's actually 7% cheaper than it was. So it's all kinds of savings. Yet another reason defeating the HST was brilliant, because you can save on BC Today. For your free two-week trial, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, it's a tax revolt. We're going to go into an interview with Tom Davidoff that we just did. Let's throw it over to that, and then we'll come back and talk about some of the other political aspects of this tax. Welcome back to Politicos, Professor Tom Davidoff, or should we call you Comrade Buzzoff Davidoff?
I think that's a very good name, Buzzoff Davidoff. You got it.
So today has been a little bit of a roller coaster for you, it sounds like. Are you doing okay?
You know, thank you. I appreciate it. I am doing well. I've had a lot of support from my university, the university president and provost and the dean of the business school, and lots of staff have really had my back when people have been pushing them to shut me up. I really am so grateful to my university. They've really bucked me up, and I appreciate it.
So the this controversy surrounding the proposed school tax changes, can you kind of walk us through what they are?
Yeah, so the school tax is going to charge people on their homes 20 basis points or 0.2% for every dollar of value between 3 and 4 million. So if you've got a house that's worth like just over 3 million, you'll basically pay nothing. If you've got a house that's worth 4 million, you'd pay 2,000 extra dollars. Now, if you have a house that's worth 10 million, it gets more expensive, because for every $1 million over $4 million, you owe $4,000 in tax. So 0.4% for every dollar over $4 million.
And this was announced during the most recent budget by the NDP.
Yeah.
Was this part of the BC Housing Affordability proposal that you'd put forward and they kind of adopted, or is this separate from that?
No, it's separate. The BC Housing Affordability Fund sort of morphed into the speculation tax. That was about people who don't use homes as primary residences or rentals. The idea of taxing more high-value properties has been around for a while. A guy who I shared a PhD advisor with at SFU, Reese Kesselman, I think, popularized the idea. But again, what the NDP did is not exactly what Reese proposed. But at a high level, I absolutely think, as I've said so many times, that it gets old to people, I'm sure, we should have higher property taxes and lower taxes on working and selling stuff in British Columbia. So that's the big reason why I favor this school tax.
This led into this protest that was on Tuesday, where a bunch of Point Grey residents gathered in Trimble Park with matching signs. To me, as a sort of lefty protester, it kind of looked like the rich trying to say, we've seen protests on TV and we think this is what it's supposed to look like. But they held this little rally with, you know, a couple dozen to 100 or so people saying, you know, this is going to tax us out of our homes. And I think that's what led into this anger and this connection between your support of this housing affordability fund in the past, and you've talked in favor of some of the NDP's proposals. And from that, it sort of escalated. And I think you told the Star to the point where people were calling on UBC to oust you?
Yeah, that's right. If people want to hold protest signs against me and call me ridiculous names and slur me for being a citizen, but an immigrant citizen, you know, that I don't mind. You know, call me whatever you want. Call me comrade Pinko. It's ridiculous, but, you know, make fun of my last name. That's great, too. But I think, you know, probably more productive to debate ideas. Where I get upset is when people ask my institution to shut me up because they don't like what I have to say. If you don't like what I have to say, provide a counter argument. We can debate it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's some institutional detail I'm missing. Maybe deferring your property taxes is much harder than I understand for some people because they've got pre-existing debt. And a lot of poor older people have pre-existing debt that would preclude them. You know, something like that. That's fine. That's great. I don't mind. And if you want to say it in a nasty way that involves curse words or slurs against any parts of my demographics, good on you. But don't try to shut down debate. That's weak.
Well, you mentioned deferrals in there, and that's been one of the responses I've seen you and a lot of people who are in favor of this position put out, because the fear is, oh, this extra tax bill, which could be $800 to several thousands of dollars for someone whose house is $5.5 million, and maybe they don't make enough to own a house that's $5.5 million, but they inherited it. And so how do you kind of respond to that? Like, maybe walk us through what those deferrals are.
So you're talking about a low-income working age person who inherited a $5.5 million house?
Well, they inherited a house that was worth much less.
I see.
And then it's gone up.
Or a senior who bought 50 years ago, okay. And the house has just appreciated that much.
Okay, so the working age person, you know, who inherited it but didn't work for a living, I think that's a very small number of people. And, you know, I don't know how sympathetic people would be to that case, but, you know, it's worth thinking about. I think a much bigger number, of course, is 55 plus. I think it's very common that people were, you know, probably, if you live on the West Side, you know, probably upper middle class or above. But in retirement, you might not have a great income, and your house could be worth double digits of millions, and this tax would be a burden if you had to pay the cash every year. However, under deferral, you don't have to pay a penny of property tax until you sell the home or you die and your estate takes over. And that's very attractive because the deferral, you pay interest, but you pay lower interest than the interest rate you'd get in putting money into treasuries. So, in fact, it's not true that I can't wait till I turn 55, but a solace of turning 55 is going to be that I'll be able to defer my taxes. I'll take the savings and put it in stocks or maybe treasuries, because it's like free money being given to you by the government. Now, some people say, but that's debt. It's abhorrent to me. And for that, I'd say a great role for a guy like Andrew Wilkinson, who is a very intelligent, accomplished guy, would be to work with industry. And I just talked to some bankers about this today. They'd be game. If they could organize a market where the borrower essentially, not the borrower, but the taxpayer essentially goes to a financial institution and says, I'm going to give you my right to borrow money at 0.7%. The institution would be willing to pay cash for that. So effectively, you could borrow $100 of your property tax this year and owe maybe $99 next year. The amount of money you'd owe could actually be reduced every year instead of increased. That might have an appeal. So let's all work together and find a way to improve deferral so that it feels less objectionable to people who do have that problem.
So outside of the people who can defer, the other counter argument to the this is too much of a burden I've seen is the home equity line of credit. Do you have any thoughts on just borrowing against the appreciating value of the house?
Yeah, I mean, houses don't always appreciate, and I think most people believe single-family homes are in for a bit of a decline. But if you bought the home any length of time ago, you've had so much appreciation that I suspect you're right. You would be able to take out a home equity line. I mean, this is 0.4% per year, which is less than the increase in interest rates that people are going to see when their mortgages reset. So I think there probably are some people who this tax could force to sell their homes. But I think as a fraction of people with homes over $3 million, it would be a very small fraction. But I don't want to minimize that. And I don't want to minimize the general fear. You know, a lot of people don't know about deferral. A home is, you know, one of your two most important needs, arguably, as a human being. And people are angry and upset. So I think let's try to find creative ways to help the small number of people who would have a liquidity problem. By expanding programs in place would be a perfectly reasonable task, maybe for a bipartisan group of legislators.
Yeah, that sounds eminently reasonable, as it were. And I think that's actually what Andrew Weaver with the Greens is really trying to do, is his focus has been on there's uproar, let's find those tweaks.
You know, he's got a very high IQ, that Andrew Weaver.
So do you have any thoughts on what those tweaks would be?
Well, again, one would be what Reese Kesselman proposed, and that's similar to our BC Housing Affordability Fund, which is if you're working age, you could write off your income taxes against your obligation. Obviously, anybody who bought a home at all recently should have a decent income and should be paying considerable income taxes. So you could have a dollar for dollar credit. Now, you might say, hey, that's kind of a giveaway. We're supposed to be taxing rich people. But on the other hand, if you looked at that crowd at Trimble Park the other day, the number of people ineligible based on age for deferral would appear to be very small.
Well, hopefully things calm down a little for you, and hopefully it doesn't scare you into not continuing to talk about the subtleties of property tax economics and how they can maybe help solve the Vancouver housing crisis.
I really appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, Twitter is a, do you say in hockey, an elbows up environment? You know, I feel like Justin Fung stepped up to defend me today, which I really appreciate. You know, we put on the pads and we duke it out. But at the end of the day, we understand we're trying to make the world a better place. You know, that's what dialogue's all about. And I enjoy a good feisty debate. You know, it's possible some people who came on Twitter new to this topic were not prepared for that type of environment. And if they took offense, I apologize. You know, can I pledge to stop snarking online? Boy, that is going to be a tough one. But I want to try because I think civil discourse, we're lucky to be able to engage in it.
Well, and where can people find you on Twitter if they want some of that civil discourse?
They can find me at Tom Davidoff.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a great night.
So Davidoff mentioned the outrage that's come at him, but it goes back a little bit further because I think the first thing that came up this last week was David Eby was announcing this event, this
town hall
over at St. James Community Center down the street, which feels like the place where every NDP Point Grey Vancouver Quadra event happens. He had tickets available online. You could register to go, express your concerns about the school tax. And then it turns out two realtors and some chap named Andrew Wilkinson circulated letters telling people to sign up, and even if they couldn't get in, to just go anyway. EB caught wind of this and was concerned, I guess, about security, and on the day of, canceled the event. He cited security concerns. He thought too many people would come in and the people who'd RSVP'd wouldn't have space. It all rang a little hollow, to be honest.
Yeah, I think he also cited some of his staff had been getting into some not very nice confrontations and a few other things like that where there's some concern over staff well-being too. But yeah, it did seem like one of those things that should probably have been addressed.
And canceling your town hall in the midst of controversy, like, this is what the Republicans are doing when they don't want to hear about why people wanted Obamacare saved. It looks cowardly. David Eby comes from a history of activism and working in nonprofits in Vancouver, where it's not that they advocated any violence or uttering threats or any endangering anyone, but there was a commitment to show up at these kind of events and not be disruptive, but make your voice heard kind of stuff. And now that it's coming at him, he shrunk back a bit.
Yeah, and I have seen the Liberals zero in on that and use that to throw around accusations of hypocrisy.
I can play a little defense for him in that it feels like there is a bit of an AstroTurf campaign being made in a way, as in Andrew Wilkinson did send a letter to BC Liberal supporters, which they may or may not live in the riding, so maybe he was just trying to get more people. Now, David Eby's a fairly prominent cabinet member, so it would be normal to travel from outside the riding to discuss it.
It's not like houses get much cheaper in that part of the city once you get south of 16th either, which is the riding boundary between him and Wilkinson's riding. So like, you can kind of see it, because both ridings are hit fairly hard with this new tax.
So you have EB cancel his event, the weird back and forth, and this, I think actually the most unique thing about this was that Andrew Wilkinson himself did sign the letter, because usually in politics you would have these operations passed off. So there's some plausible deniability. It's not the leader's office trying to stage a protest. These are people rising up on their own, as it were, not the party told them to. But the Liberals are new to opposition. They're new to protest. As I mentioned when we were talking with Tom, that protest they held at Trimble Park was like quaint in how they tried to put it on. I've seen some pictures from around Point Grey, and I'll have to do a walk around the neighborhood soon, of some of these mansions that have the big signs plastered outside their newly renovated homes saying no to the school tax. And one person, one house in particular that was on Twitter, someone even pointed out, is only a year old. So that person can't claim that their house just accumulated passively in value. It's still fun, kind of, to watch the attempted revolt. The other angle that came up interestingly this week was former BC Premier Mike Harcourt decided to weigh in.
Yes, and not in the way you would expect of a, well, this is the NDP's policy, and, you know, I'm a former NDP premier, let's go to bat for, you know, the schools and everything. Like, one would it?
No, you expect. Have not been following NDP politics in BC long enough. What you should actually always expect is NDP former leaders to stab current ones in the back. Ujjal Dasanjh, Glenn Clark, Mike Harcourt, go back as far as you want. They got to speak their mind, and now you have Mike Harcourt saying, yeah, this tax seems ill thought out. We thought about it back in my day at a lower level, and we canceled it then, and now they should go back on it. I mean, it does churn out that Harcourt happens to live in Point Grey and has a $3.5 million house, so he will be facing like a $900 property tax bill increase because of this. I'm sure that's totally unrelated, though. And I'm sure he's just really concerned with the top wealth holders in terms of land value in Metro Vancouver.
Yeah, it just seems a little out of place and not really reading the room, so to speak, on where the city is. And I basically saw everybody who doesn't own a $3 million plus house mocking and or deriding the protesters on this. And it didn't seem to really resonate at all outside of that core West Side millionaire group.
I've seen talk about whether this is a fair tax or not. And I think that misses the mark in terms of, was it fair that someone's house went from $1 million to $5 million when they just happened to live there? Is it fair that people can't afford houses now?
And if Mike Hartort had had more foresight and actually put in place better policies when he was mayor of Vancouver and then premier of British Columbia, you know, maybe we wouldn't be in this situation right now. So,
or Glenn Clark or Gordon Campbell.
There's lots of blame to go around.
But the point you're getting at is it's a long-term problem, right? It's something that has developed and exacerbated due to, especially I feel like very recently, just like a lack of action on anything, especially when you could, I can sort of forgive Gordon Campbell perhaps for not noticing at that point, but under Christy Clark, things really started to heat up. And we remember that summer where she recalled the legislature to pass the foreign buyers tax. And that's kind of the only thing. And then she didn't, I think, hold a fall session or fall sitting that year. So all that kind of is to say we're left with this situation where things got out of hand, and trying to solve a crisis like this inevitably means someone loses. And to date, it's been young people trying to get into the market, renters, and the poor and marginalized who have borne the brunt. And now the NDP is like, well, let's maybe shift a bit of the burden onto people with multi-million dollar houses, and we're supposed to feel bad.
It's a 0.2% tats on multimillionaires. It's just a very small incremental increase in taxation around an issue that is, you know, having some very serious negative effects on the city and the province as a whole. And it's just hard to see how this represents a burden, or it's even harder to see how the level of outrage is in any way proportional to the burden faced by the millionaires.
Like, I can see this playing well for Andrew Wilkinson's core, like, stereotypical Andrew Wilkinson type BC liberal, the lawyer doctor with multiple degrees and letters after his name who feels attacked. And it plays into a narrative that he can start to spin, and you're starting to see him do it, of here's the NDP bringing in this speculation tax, the school tax, the MSP payroll tax, 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 tax. And then we're going to get into the NDP spending because they need to do the childcare and other things. And so there's the narrative he can start to build. The problem is, I feel like you're saying, that we're at the crisis point where people have been so frustrated that action at this point is better than inaction. And unless he's proposing an alternate solution, here we are.
Yeah, and that's the problem. He hasn't proposed an alternate solution to any of this, either to fund schools, which is what the TATS money is in theory going to be going to, because we now actually have to increase spending to deal with some of the cuts that were made under the Liberals and the requirements around hiring more teachers, seismically upgrading the school. Like, money needs to be spent here, and there's no two ways about it. If you don't do that, tats in an inelastic asset like property makes a huge amount of sense. And, you know, would Andrew Wilkinson rather see the income tats go up? It's just one of those things where you need to raise some money, and this is as good a way as any.
It's worth pointing out the school tax isn't 100% of the Ministry of Education's budget. The government of BC, I'm on their website right now because I was trying to remember, I think this tax actually just does go into general revenue. So it's not that there will necessarily be $250 million more, which is what this tax is expected to bring in, going into schools. The quote-unquote schools tax, according to the government, represents approximately 35% of the $5.5 billion we spent in 2015 and 2016. The school tax revenue was $1.9 billion. So a whole bunch of other money is just made up from general revenue. This is, I think, what we've talked to other people about healthcare funding. Like the MSP.
It's only a slice of the overall funding.
Yeah. Basically, money just comes from income tax and just the corporate tax and who knows where else. Somehow we're paying for everything and it's always kind of magic.
But yeah, circling back to the narrative, it yet becomes an issue. But I think there's also a sense that we haven't made the investments we needed to recently, and especially for stuff such as seismically upgrading schools, hiring the right number of teachers, and funding transit. There's housing. These are areas where the last government very clearly didn't spend enough on, and we're going to need to make it up somehow. And that's either going to be having to cut something else, which I haven't heard Andrew Wilkinson give any idea suggestions on, or it means new taxes, and it's kind of where we are with it.
It's kind of funny, like the day Gordon Campbell became premier was like the day he slashed taxes by absurd amounts. It was like 20%. And then we're still kind of living through those consequences of now we have gross underfunding of all our services and no government is going to come in and go, well, we're going to have to re-up all of the income taxes by 20% because that would be a real revolt. So they're kind of picking and choosing like little taxes here and there, which hopefully also deal with some of these housing issues. So I think part of the hope with creating a progressive property tax essentially is it kind of dissuades you from wanting a rich house, an expensive house.
Yeah, and there's actually literature that shows that property values are inversely correlated with property taxes.
In other words, people will sell these rich mansions. They probably won't be able to get their exact assessed amount, and so it'll dampen the mansion prices.
In fact, we already see that the detached housing sales are at the lowest point in over a decade.
And it's probably not going to make a Point Grey single detached home affordable for anyone, but
a single detached home in Point Grey will never be affordable again. Like, it's just the reality of the housing market here.
But we can start to cool things down a bit on that side and use some of that income to also help build affordable housing and hopefully play around with some other tools. And we'll see where this all goes. But there's some people who are very upset that this tax is being used when we should just be going after foreign speculators or this or that. And honestly, there was never going to be a magic bullet. And so the 31 point or whatever it was housing plan that they put in the budget included this and it'll work.
Going after foreign money also isn't going to make that Point Grey detached house $200,000. It's not going to happen. And that's just the reality of it.
So like we spoke with Tom, the Greens are looking at this and signaling that they'll probably push for some changes. I think the NDP will probably find a way to make we're going to do some, we've listened, we've heard your complaints. They'll find some ways to make sure that the biggest heat comes down and we'll go forward. This tax, I don't think, is going away, but in a couple of weeks, we'll be back to yelling about Kinder Morgan and then we'll be on to yelling about electoral reform. And from there, I'm sure there's lots more things we can always expect the anti-NDP forces to be screaming about, because that's how this province works.
Well, moving on to quit tates, we're starting off on a bit of a sad note as MP Gord Brown has passed away this week from a heart attack in his Parliament Hill office. He's the Conservative MP for Leeds, Grenville, Thousand Islands, and Rideau Lake. And he's been in Parliament since 2004. And this was, I think, really sudden, took everyone by surprise.
Yeah, I can't say I actually knew his name. I think he was always a Conservative backbencher, but it sounds like he was close with Peter MacKay. And so he'd always been in Progressive Conservative and Conservative circles. And everyone had nice things to say for about him. And it's always sad when a politician dies in office, especially when it's literally in office.
Only 57, too.
Yeah. Hopefully his family is doing well, and sorry to hear that. Well, also at the federal level, the Government of Canada has unsurprisingly announced that it will be intervening in the BC reference case on the, not on the Kinder Morgan pipeline, it's on the changes to the Environmental Protections Act of BC that affects transport of heavy oil by rail, truck, and pipeline. Obviously, this is the Kinder Morgan reference case. We don't know what the federal government's going to say specifically, but they've signaled, obviously, that they're going to argue strongly in favor that BC doesn't have this power and they should get out of the way of the pipeline.
Yeah, it's more or less what everyone expected to have happen. When they actually put forward their case, I'm sure we'll be talking about it in more detail, and might get Mike or someone who actually knows the legal stuff on to break it down. But in the meantime, we're just watching and keeping an eye on what's happening there. Well, speaking of energy, BC Hydro's announced that they're going to go to the BC Utilities Commission to ask them to change the net metering program, whereby under the current system, people who and companies that have, you know, small renewable energy like solar panels or whatever can sell onto the grid, basically. And, you know, if you end up putting more onto the grid than you took off, BC Hydro will send you a check at the end of the year. And they're looking to change that, or at least not take any newcomers into the program.
BC Hydro is alleging that some people are not using the program as it was intended. So the intention is you put solar panels on your roof, and if it's too sunny, you can sell that electricity, like you said. But apparently some people have gone overboard or are, I don't know, installing solar farms and wind, somehow overgenerating electricity and selling too much back. And they feel like this is costing them too much money, and therefore they need to cut those people out. And it's very weird because the program's still a really good idea. And to just like axe the program over this seems a bit dodgy.
Yeah, it's a little odd. I could see how this could be a money loser in theory, because they're paying back at 9.9 cents for kilowatt hour, where don't use much electricity, you can pay as little as 8.5. So, you know, maybe there's a money-losing argument there, but if anything, it's probably more likely they're expecting to bring online a whole lot of new power generation within a few years, or within the next decade, assuming, you know, that major project actually comes in on time, which it won't, because it's a major project. Maybe that has something to do with it, but yeah, it's surprising. And like, BC doesn't actually have all that much renewable, or at least small scale renewable energy, like, to the point where it causes problems with the grid or anything. And you know, since we use hydro for the rest of it, it actually works fairly well with these sorts of small scale stuff, because it's really fairly easy to adjust how much a dam's generating to accommodate the peaks and troughs in demand and supply from the solar panels and whatnot. So from a technical standpoint, it doesn't make much sense of why this would be causing them any problems.
Well, in full credit to BC Green leader Andrew Weaver for speaking out on this and trying to raise the alarm and get some attention paid to this. Ultimately, this is a BC Utility Commission decision, and it is an arm's length body. So if he wants the government to play around in there, I think he's probably going against things he's probably said in the past on other issues. But hopefully the BC Utility Commission can look at this coherently and make an informed decision. Perhaps, you know, we're totally misreading the case, and it may be the fact that, hey, maybe there are some people out there who shouldn't be small scale power producers, but are actually large scale. Like, maybe you've actually opened a power plant, but you're pretending to just have some solar panels on your house. And maybe in that case, you should be at a different rate and you shouldn't be in this program. Maybe that's the problem, but
yeah, it's, at that point, it would seem to be one of those things where, you know, if you're generating 10,000 kilowatt hours a month, yeah, maybe at that point you should actually have a power purchase agreement with BC Hydro rather than net meter. But you know, it seems like one of those things where you could tweak the program so that this program only applies to, say, people who produce less than 2,000 or whatever the number is, and just go with that rather than strap the whole program or stop taking new applicants.
So we'll keep our eye on what BCUC does. While we're with Andrew Weaver, though, he has announced this week that he plans to introduce another private member's bill. He's been quite consistent at introducing those, but this one, interestingly, is the first bill that was written with the new legislative drafting service that the Confidence and Supply Agreement helped set up. In the BC legislature, the government is able to access bureaucrats who can help them draft laws that don't suck, basically, because it's very...
Or suck less than they would otherwise.
Yeah. Well, ones that don't obviously conflict with existing ones, and there might still be a couple holes, as has turned out, but...
So if your expertise is, say, in climate science, you don't necessarily know how to do all the law stuff right, so having somebody whose job it is to do that is very helpful if you want to write laws.
So Weaver went to this office and asked them to help him write something for B Corps or benefit corporations, and through that he's come up with amendments for the Business Corporations Act that would basically create a legislative structure for these benefit corporations in BC, and this would be a first of its kind in Canada, where you could create legally a association, a for-profit association, that could also write into its documents that it had to have like a triple bottom line, a social, environmental, sustainability purposes.
Yeah, so it gets around the issue where, you know, if a company wants to be more responsible within it, you know, and have another target, it gets a little complicated if that actually hurts the bottom line because of the fiduciary duty the board of directors and CEO and whatnot has to the shareholders. So this kind of gets around that by also being able to say, yeah, we're doing that, but we also have to do this thing here too. And, you know, one doesn't take precedence over the other.
And these are companies that still want to make profit, because you can make a charity or a nonprofit, but then your board members can't take a cut of your earnings. So I'm totally in favor of this. It allows for greater diversity and smarter companies that aren't just obsessed with cutting costs and raising prices. Weaver's press release points out that Patagonia, Kickstarter, and Method Home Products are three major companies that have already tried to commit to this triple bottom line. And Patagonia and Kickstarter are very Vancouver type companies, just in the feel of it. So he's optimistic that this could be the first bill to come to fruition through this process and become law. And notably, in his press release, he even claims this could be the first private members bill in BC's history to be passed into law. And that was quite the incredible claim to me.
Raise both of our eyebrows on this one.
Like, most private members bills at the federal level,
or any level,
become,
really,
or at any level, don't generally become laws because they're more signaling exercises.
Yeah, and they don't even always. Yeah, and they don't even always get voted down. It's just the government's deciding what bills are going to be heard at what time. And oh, well, look at that. We're at the end of the session, and we haven't quite gotten around to any of your private members bills yet. So they're going to die on the order paper.
And I went through the last couple sessions of BC legislatures and BC parliaments, because I do remember specifically news stories about Christy Clark saying, for example, to Andrew Weaver, oh, I'm going to take up your campus sexual assault bill and make sure that becomes law. And I think there was a bill about wearing high heels at work. You wouldn't have to be forced to do that. But it turns out what actually happens is the government goes, oh, that's a great private members bill. Let's rewrite it so it doesn't suck. And we'll have that come forward as a government bill and we'll fast track it. The only bill I could find of a private members bill in the last two or three sessions that became a law was the Terry Fox Act, which was a nine-word bill that said the second Monday of September will be Terry Fox Day. period. So I put this to Andrew Weaver on Twitter to say, is that really true? And is the Greens press secretary, Gillian Oliver, got back to me and said, although ideas from past private members' bills have been adopted, they've always been rewritten and introduced as government legislation because until late last year, legislative drafters were not made available to opposition parties. The particular BC legislature rules don't favor collaboration. So I'm optimistic about this bill, and hopefully the BC NDP takes it forward because it's still ultimately up to the government what bills come up when. But if they're committed to this legislative drafting service and not just wasting some bureaucrats' time and money, they'll bring it forward, and at least for a hearty debate. And hell, this is something BC Liberals can probably get behind. And maybe we'll even get someone from the BC Greens or some advocate for this bill on to further explain what benefit corporations are and why we should care more about this bill. Well, and finally, an update on a story out of the federal NDP caucus. I don't know if we touched on this before, but Saskatchewan MP Aaron Weir has officially been expelled from caucus following a number of complaints against him. And there were weird stories a few months ago where not a lot was said other than there were allegations for him and they were being dealt with internally. And then he was suspended from caucus. Party took on a third-party investigator to look into these, and the results just came back this past week, and the investigator found support for one claim of harassment and three claims of sexual harassment. And so Jagmeet Singh, as leader, said, sorry, Aaron, you're out of the party. And Aaron Weir went on a tirade in the middle of that, I think, where he claimed this is all a vendetta because he disagreed with the party's carbon tax position. Figuring this out was difficult because Aaron Weir is not against pricing carbon. He's against the Liberals' approach to it. But he claims that Thomas Mulcair, when he was leader, censored him and tried to prevent him from asking questions in question period to Justin Trudeau about the carbon tax and what impact that would have on his Saskatchewan residents. But looking back through Aaron Weir's environmental platform, which is still up on his website from the previous election, and some of his comments elsewhere, what he basically favors is a tax on imports from countries that price carbon less than Canada to make up for it. So a sort of, not a tariff, because that would probably violate a bunch of trade agreements, but a way to encourage other countries to tax carbon. And Peter Julian, during the leadership race, actually endorsed this idea. And to some extent, it kind of makes sense if we're going to have a carbon tax that don't want to export that carbon.
Yeah, and that's always been the argument, or one of the arguments against the carbon tax, is it's not so much a disincentive as a shift in where carbon is produced. So, yeah, there's an argument behind it for sure.
But his claim that this was such a fundamental disagreement with the party that he was censored and now like give the victim of false allegations to the point where they're kicking him out of the party, it just rings really hollow to me. Like, I don't buy it. I'm sure Thomas Mulcair probably said, you know, don't go after Justin Trudeau on the carbon tax because we're in favor of pricing carbon and the Conservatives are just trying to deny climate change as even happening or let us do anything. So you're setting us back if you spend your time on this. So we have an investigation. It turns up these sexual assault complaints and I have no reason to doubt them. And so,
although it's worth pointing out the final report actually hasn't been released yet or any of the findings made public. It's just, this is the inference based on the actions taken.
Yeah.
And there's some issues around confidential information in there that need to be sorted out before anything can be made public.
There's a lot of internal party processes that never make it public. So I'm not surprised on that. And I would be surprised if we found a lot of things. And with harassment allegations, you don't want to out the victim because it's already hard enough to come forward. So
the NDP's promised they'll release only non-confidential parts, but we'll have to wait and see on that.
It is a tough moment for Jagmeet Singh, though. Now he has to probably run a nomination race in Regina, where Aaron Weir may now run as an independent, or if Jagmeet Singh is lucky, Weir will kind of disappear from federal politics. But things could get very heated in that local constituency association, and this is probably not the last difficulty for a political party to deal with the whole Me Too campaign.
And that has been Politos. Find links to stories you mentioned in the show notes at politos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.